That would be a yes.
Did you see which way Trigger drove off?
He said he was going to a party at Lake Maloney.
If this goes further and Trigger is arrested and charged, you may be subpoenaed to testify as a witness in court.
A cold shudder whipped up my spine. Would creating a case against Trigger bring me media attention I couldn't afford? Someone needed to stand up to him, but was it worth exposing myself? I remembered Danny Bilondo staring me down from behind the two-way glass in the police lineup. He hadn't been able to see me, but he knew I was there. His chilling gaze made no attempt to disguise what he wanted to do to me. Would this small-town case spread to national media? No, I decided. It was fear, cold and persuasive, trying to scare me away. No problem, I told the officer. He didn't know I was Witsec. Only Carmina and the sheriff knew. Again, his eyebrows soared as if to say, "Bad call, little miss." I was amazed he didn't seem pleased, or even grateful, that one of his fellow citizens was stepping forward to do the right thing. Granted, I had my own selfish reasons for wanting to see Trigger busted, but the officer didn't know that. Either way, I definitely got the impression he was trying to get me to back down. Forget it. Trigger was a douche, and if he got a DWI or worse, it was his own fault, not mine.
"Anything else?" the officer asked.
"Yeah, thanks for being so helpful." I smiled when I said it, but it was probably a good thing he couldn't hear my thoughts, which weren't nearly as polite. It was Friday after sundown, and Chet would be by any minute to pick me up. My first weekend on the town. I never thought I'd see the day when I was this excited for a softball game. But hey, beggars can't be choosers. A night out was a night out. I'd played softball in PE and knew the basics, so I wasn't worried about making a fool of myself. Besides, Chet had told me the league was slow pitch. You had to be really uncoordinated to not hit a ball the size of a grapefruit as it lobbed at a glacial pace across home plate. While getting ready for the game, which included dropping a tee over my head and braiding my hair, I was seized by an unexpected punch to my gut. Out of nowhere, the sobering truth hit me. I couldn't believe it had taken me this long to see it. I would never play basketball again. Not at the collegiate level. My senior year of high school down through third grade, I'd spent every winter playing basketball. It was my sport. I was good at it. Sophomore year, I'd been bumped up to play a couple of varsity games, and by junior year, I was one of the starting five. I received offers to play for Babson College and Penn State, finally committing to Babson. I lowered myself onto the edge of my bed. I gripped the baseball glove I'd taken from the closet, the one Carmina had said I could borrow. I clung to it like it was my lifeline. I was numb, my pain cutting too deep for tears. Gazing with hollow eyes at the wall, I let the truth swarm in. Before I'd been flown to Nebraska to start my newly incarnated life, I'd known exactly what my future held. A summer of fun and travel with my best friend, Tori, followed by college in the fall. Tori and I were supposed to be in Atlantic City right now. Did she know what had become of me? Did she think I was dead? I felt selfish and ashamed for taking so long to wonder how my friends might be handling my disappearance. As far as I understood, the detectives and U.S. Marshals had not and would not explain what had become of me. It was their job to make me vanish. No breadcrumb trail left for anyone, good or bad, to follow. Given everything that had happened since being whisked into Witsec just over a week ago, I hadn't had a chance to mourn my old life, or fully grasp how vastly different, how completely alien, my new future would be. I struggled to quell the panic and dizziness that seemed to aim alternating blows at me. Those dreams of playing for Babson, of donning a green and white jersey, gone. My scholarship had dissolved with my identity. My career was finished. I'd never play for myself, my team, or the crowds again. And I'd given it up for what? To put Danny Bilondo behind bars. I'd done the right thing, and it had cost me
everything. Deputy Price had mentioned the government would create new records to help me get into college. But what college? In their suits and badges, the detectives had pretended to have all the answers. But could they tell me this? At 17, how was I supposed to start from scratch? The idea of fully accepting Stella Gordon's future gave me a deep, trembling fear of losing myself, of becoming invisible.
Stella? Carmina called from downstairs. Chet just pulled up.
I shook off my thoughts and breathed deeply until the numbness left. There was no use looking back. There was nothing for me in the past but heartache and remorse. It hurt too much to dwell on everything I'd lost. I walked downstairs, shakily, testing my smile. It felt strained and brittle, and I kept smiling until I got it right. If Chet saw even a suggestion of sorrow, he'd press me on it. If I wanted to avoid his inquiries, I had to pull off normal. Get it together. The outside lights were on, and I could see Chet making his way up the porch steps. He had on knee-length nylon shorts and a worn gray t-shirt that looked as soft as tissue. It clung to his body, highlighting his toned chest and shoulders. In Philly, the boys I knew who had a body like Chet's spent hours at the gym after school. Since there wasn't a gym in Thunder Basin, it was safe to assume Chet earned his body the old-fashioned way, performing manual labor. He saw us through the screen door and invited himself inside.
Carmina?
Evening, Chet, she said in a measured tone. You'll have Stella back by 11:30. An order, not a request. Her curfew is 9, but I'm making an exception for the game. I don't have to work tomorrow, I told Chet. I can sleep in. We can stay out as late as we want.
Curfew is 11:30, Carmina repeated firmly.
It's Friday night, I said, giving her a look that said she was treating me like a child and needed to stop immediately. What if there's a party after the game?
Kindly tell your friends you won't be going.
I don't have friends. That's the point. You keep me caged up in this house. You knew I was a teenager when you signed on for this, so why do you keep acting like I'm 5?
All right, Chet said loudly, stepping between us. The game starts in 30. We should get going, Stella.
He turned to Carmina.
I'll have her back by 11:30.
My jaw dropped. You're letting her have her way. He put his arm around my shoulders and steered me carefully out the door.
You got a mitt?
He knew I had a baseball glove. I was holding it. He was purposefully changing the subject to distract me. And against the voice in my head that was screaming for me to turn back and have it out with Carmina to give her the fight she seemed to want, I bit my tongue, choosing instead to fume in silence. I'd rejected most of my mother's early attempts to raise me properly, but in this one instance, I took her instruction and decided to spare Chet needless embarrassment. I'd wait to give Carmina my opinion of her actions in private. Chet closed the screen door behind us and audibly let go of the breath he'd been holding. Someone needs to stand up to her, I argued, directing my pent-up frustration at him. You're obviously afraid to, but I'm not. If there's a party after the game, we're going. What's the worst Carmina can do? Kick me out? I shut my mouth to keep from saying more, but that didn't stop me from thinking it. Go ahead, kick me out. Let's see how fast it takes Price and his friends at the DOJ to show up on your doorstep. Chet opened my car door, shutting it wordlessly behind me. We didn't talk on the drive to the softball field, and I wondered if this was some secret ploy of his to give me time to cool off. Well, I didn't feel like cooling off. I knew there was history between Chet and Carmina, and I knew she strongly disliked him. Or, at least, didn't want me around him. But this was getting ridiculous. She couldn't keep us apart by punishing me. I wouldn't tolerate it. But the real issue was that Chet should be taking my side. That's what I really wanted. He had a lot of things going for him, but his insistence on being polite to Carmina wasn't one of them. It was what I loved about Reed. He took my side, even if it meant going against my mom. He wasn't afraid of her. Of course, most of the time when he had come over, she'd been passed out in bed, but the point was, he was on my side. I couldn't say the same of Chet.
The deeper this realization sank, the more betrayed I felt.
Chet parked and glanced at me warily. I jumped out of the scout and shut the door, hard. I wanted him to know I was upset. Maybe it would give him something to think about. If he was trying to get on my good side, sweetening up to Carmina wasn't the way. She meant nothing to me. She basically was my parole officer.
Stadium lights blazed on the raked dirt of the infield and the thick green grass of the outfield. The foul lines were freshly chalked, and the concession stand had a line trailing down the sidewalk.
"You play before?"
Chet asked as he led the way to our team's dugout. "Wiffle ball counts, right?"
He gave me a startled rake of his eyes.
Relax,
I've played. But it's been a while, so don't expect a home run on my first at bat. Chet trotted down the steps to the dugout and cleared his throat to get the team's attention.
"Everyone, this is Stella, the new player I told you about. Stella, this is the team. I won't bother with individual introductions. You guys can introduce yourselves better than I can. Except to tell Stella to watch out for that guy in the Broncos hat. He thinks he's Don Juan."
Everyone laughed, apparently finding some truth in the joke.
"Don Juan's got nothing on me," the guy in the Broncos hat said in a voice like silken chocolate. "I'm the real deal."
He winked at me, puckering his lips to blow me an air kiss. I blew a kiss back, then stared him down smugly, showing him I could handle anything he wanted to dish out. The team ate this up, laughing and teasing Don Juan. When the laughing died down, I took a seat on the end of the bench, startled to find that the girl next to me was wearing perfume. It was so strong it seemed to leak from every pore. I glanced furtively at her, noting she was wearing lipstick, too. Actually, she had a whole face of makeup. Leaning forward so I could see down the entire bench, I observed the rest of the girls. One had curled her golden hair into ringlets. Another wore denim shorts studded with rhinestones and hoop earrings. I was the only girl who looked like she'd actually come to play softball. Once upon a time, I'd been one of them. I'd cared what I'd looked like, especially when boys were involved. But I wasn't Estella Goodwin anymore. I was Stella Gordon. I'd already traded my Manolo Blahniks for softball cleats, and now I was going to have to trade my expensive salon haircuts for the mom-and-pop barbershop version. I hadn't seen another option in Thunder Basin, and more importantly, I was on a monthly government stipend. Not wanting Danny Bilondo's cartel to trace my family's money from our bank accounts and use the paper trail to find me, the government had seized our assets and allotted me a monthly payout, which was about as generous as you'd expect from the government. Given my monetary restraints and my inability to care about keeping up Stella Gordon's facade, I didn't see the point in trying to be fashionable or pretty anymore. I didn't even know who I was anymore.
"I'm Sydney," the girl next to me, the one drenched in perfume, said.
She had the sweet, translucent face of a milkmaid and blonde braids to match. "Stella," I replied, thinking this conversation was a waste since she and I would never be friends. I had her figured out in all of 30 seconds. She was the sweet, innocent country type. She'd probably marry straight out of high school and have a kid before her 20th birthday. Of course, I'd been wrong about Innie. I had to remember that. Maybe I'd find I was wrong about Sydney, too. I remembered Chet's admonition to give the town, and those in it, a chance before blowing them off. I supposed I could take his advice.
"So, you're friends with Chet?"
Sydney asked.
"I noticed he gave you a ride."
"I don't have a car, and he lives close by." Her brow scrunched in confusion.
"He lives out in the meadows on Sapphire Skies. He doesn't really have neighbors. Where do you live?"
"I'm staying at Carmina Songster's for the summer."
Her eyes went round and she said,
"Oh."
I could tell by the tone of her voice that she'd heard of me, whether from Chet or someone else I couldn't say.
"Just for the summer, though," she confirmed.
"That's the plan." I decided it was more polite than, "Yes, hallelujah."
"I've known Chet a long time. When I was little, I had a crush on him, but I'm so over that now, she added with a laugh, then studied me a little too closely while she waited for my response.
He seems like a pretty cool guy.
Oh, yeah. She kneaded her hands uncomfortably in her lap.
Chet, who'd been going over the batting lineup with the team, crouched in front of Sydney and me.
Stella, you're batting third and playing right field. Sydney, you're batting seventh and playing center. Sound good?
Sydney nodded, smiling eagerly, no, adoringly, at Chet. He didn't appear to notice, ruffling her hair like he would a kid sister.
When he shifted his attention to me, I pinned him with an unmistakable look of reprimand, then darted my eyes toward Sydney, who sat beside me unaware. I was very obviously trying to communicate to him that he had treated Sydney improperly and should give her a different kind of attention. His brow furrowed, and he shook his head slightly, indicating he didn't understand. With exasperation, I jerked my head more vigorously in Sydney's direction.
Sydney?
Chet began uncertainly, glancing at me for confirmation that he was proceeding correctly.
Would you like to join me at the pitcher's mound for the coin toss?
I beamed, signaling he'd done well. But he once again wagged his head in confusion, eyeing me like I'd sprouted alien antenna.
Chet and Sydney jogged to the pitcher's mound for the coin toss, then returned to tell us we'd bat first. The umpires took their places on the field, one behind home plate, the other behind first base. Don Juan was first up to bat.
What's his real name? I asked Chet, who had taken a seat on the bench beside me.
Juan. Yeah, I know. Irony.
At bat, Juan swung powerfully and missed. Even from here, I heard him swear in Spanish. The umpire pointed a warning finger at him, spoke a few stern words, and the rest of our team giggled behind their hands.
Showboat,
Chet muttered, shaking his head, but he was smiling.
Is he your best friend? I asked.
That's such a girl thing to say, he thumbed his nose. But, yeah, I guess that's what he is.
He sat by me at lunch in kindergarten and split his Twinkie with me.
The rest is history.
For the second time, I glanced down the bench to survey our team. Anyone else you should warn me about?
Yeah, the shortstop. He's tough on the field, but he wears his heart on his sleeve.
He nudged his thigh against mine, and the air around us seemed to grow heavy and harder to breathe. Chet's playfulness felt awfully affectionate, and his intentions way too direct. I laughed airily, trying to lighten the mood, but felt the sudden urge to step out of the dugout and get some fresh air. Chet was flirting with me. It had to stop. Reed was my boyfriend. I made a mental note to swing by the library first chance I got, probably before work on Monday, and check the email account. Surely he'd left a message by now. But that didn't help me tonight. I needed to dispel any notions in Chet's head that I was willing to take our relationship to a new level. And I needed to dispel them now. I also needed to get myself under control. Chet was being alarmingly direct, and I wasn't used to it. Reed had never overtly flirted with me. His way of showing he cared was always subtle. Touching my hand, meeting my eyes across a room, playing my favorite songs when we were driving in his car. He was secretive about everything he did, including revealing emotion, which meant I had to work a little harder to notice his affection. In contrast, Chet was straightforward and open. It made me feel almost uncomfortable, like stepping into noonday sun after a lengthy period indoors. It also made my heart yearn dangerously for more. Juan had struck out and was walking back dejectedly to the dugout, and I seized my chance. Can't even make it to first base, I quipped as he threw his bat down in self-disgust.
With you, Cariño, I'd go all the way to home.
With fluid grace, Juan inserted himself between me and Chet and draped his arm over my shoulder.
Don't be nervous. I'm a good teacher.
Knock it off, Chet said, giving him a playful shove off the bench, but I noticed Chet's face had turned slightly pink.
Not giving up, Juan pulled me to my feet,
pressed my body to his and engaged me in a seductive Latin dance, humming a melodic tune in my ear. I played along, dancing with him, grateful that his comical routine had quickly diffused the loaded moment Chet and I had experienced back there. I laughed. "You're good, I'll give you that."
"I'm the gift that keeps on giving," Juan murmured tantalizingly against my cheek.
"Okay, break it up. Stella's next at bat," Chet reminded us. He handed me a bat and tipped his head at home plate.
"Go get 'em, slugger."
I took a few practice swings outside the dugout while the girl at bat hit a fly ball that was caught by the third baseman. The ump pronounced her out, and I stepped into the batter's box. In the dugout, I could hear Chet whistling and clapping for me. He was a good team captain, and was shaping up to be a good friend, and I told myself that's all we'd ever be. Friends. I settled my feet in the dirt and choked up on the bat. It was a little long, and I was only aiming for a base hit. No flashy tricks tonight. The pitcher rocked back on her heel, then sent the ball in an easy lob toward me. I went after the first pitch with an aggressive swing. I heard the crack of the ball, tossed the bat aside, and ran. I'd squeezed a line drive between shortstop and second and easily made it to first base. While our dugout erupted in cheering, I bobbed a curtsy. Chet grinned ear to ear, but I quickly avoided eye contact, choosing to pucker up for Juan instead, who was drawing a circle in the air with his finger, a clear innuendo for going all the way. Chet followed me at bat and pulled off a double after hitting a pop fly deep into left field. We played 7 innings and won the game 5-4, bumping our season record to 3-0. After the game, both teams dispersed to the parking lot, and I watched anxiously as one by one the players got into their cars and drove off. Was no one going to invite me to a party tonight? Not even Juan? He seemed like a guy who'd be on the lookout for a good time and open to a tag-along. I knew Chet would try to talk me into going back to Carmina's, especially since it was after 11. But that was the last thing I wanted. If I made it back on time, I was letting her win, and I refused to do that. Feeling deflated, I walked with Chet to the scout. He opened my door, even though I wished he hadn't. The gesture felt more than polite. It felt intimate, like I was his date. I suddenly feared he might try to walk me to Carmina's door and get me alone on her porch. Whatever happened, I couldn't let him do that. As we settled into our seats, I decided the best course of action was to keep things chummy. Be one of the guys. I kicked my heels up on the dash, smiling mischievously. Sydney likes you. Halfway through the game, she'd cinched her jersey in a knot at her waist, showing off her curvy midriff. She'd also spent every free minute chatting off Chet's ear. Whether you lived in the city or the country, some signals were universal. Chet glanced bemusedly at me.
"What, Sydney?" He shook his head. "No way. She's got a boyfriend. Some bull rider from Hershey. They've been together a while."
"She had her eye on you all night, lover boy."
"You're imagining things."
"Did you smell how much perfume she was wearing? At first whiff, I thought it was Juicy Couture, but now I'm almost positive it was pheromones to attract Chet Falconer."
He groaned. "Stop."
"I've got a point, and you know it."
"I know no such thing."
"Do you have a girlfriend?" I asked him directly. He thumbed his nose some more and cleared his throat.
"What?"
"You heard me."
"What would make you think I have a girlfriend?"
"Do you?"
"No, I don't," he said,
sounding slightly offended that I even had to ask.
"Why?"
With that one question, our conversation took a sudden serious and personal turn, and I didn't like it. So I changed the subject. "When are you taking me out for that celebratory dinner?"
"Whenever you want."
"I was hoping you'd say that," I said, smiling triumphantly and wickedly in equal measure. "I want to go now." Chet sighed and gave me a reprehensible look.
"I promised Carmina I'd have you home by 11:30.
"Not even coffee," I pleaded,
batting my lashes persuasively. His eyes flicked to the clock on the dash, 11:20.
A&W is still open.
Drive-through root beer floats, final offer. I frowned.
You drive a hard bargain.
Me? You kidding? Mirror's right there, he said, gesturing at the fold-down visor. You in or out?
In, I said, but I made sure to affect a sulky tone.
Chet drove across town, pulled through the A&W's drive-thru, and paid for two floats. I couldn't remember the last time I'd had a root beer float. They used soft-serve vanilla ice milk, not the real stuff, but it was still surprisingly good. Chet drove to a nearby park, and we sat in the empty lot with the windows down. The air felt warm and sticky, but with a cold dessert in my hand, I didn't mind.
Do you have a job? I asked, besides mowing lawns.
He snorted.
You say that like mowing lawns is a lame job.
You don't have to talk to anyone. You don't even have to shower or dress up, I pointed out.
I only mow two lawns, Carmina's and my own. During the day, I work at Milton Swope's ranch. I cut hay, maintain the pasture, and look after the cattle.
Go on. He gave me a sidelong glance, gauging to see whether I spoke out of genuine interest or to gain fodder I could tease him with.
It's hard work, but never boring. I can be riding a tractor one day, mending a fence the next, and chasing down a lost calf the day after that. Best part, come rain or shine, I'm outdoors, not stuck in some office hunched over a computer.
The sun will prematurely age your skin, I pointed out practically. His laughter turned genuine.
My mom worked in her garden most of her adult life. She had smile lines, crow's feet, and sun wrinkles, and she was the most beautiful woman I've ever known.
I'm sorry about your mom, Chet. I'm sorry about both your parents.
He shrugged. I appreciate that. It gets easier over time. Maybe not easier, just more tolerable. I think it helps knowing they're not completely gone. I don't believe in a god who creates beings only to let them stop existing. Matter isn't created or destroyed, just transferred, right? I can't see my parents and I can't talk to them, but I feel them. They're out there. Knowing this makes the loss less painful.
After a pause, he smiled slightly.
Knowing my mom is keeping an eye on me forces me to reconsider every time I'm tempted to whip the hide off Dusty's back.
I don't believe in God, I said bluntly. If there was a God, I don't understand why he'd let horrible things happen. A God who lets people suffer, who lets people behave abominably toward each other. That's not a God. That's a sadist.
I know people who feel the way you do. Dusty is one of them. He doesn't understand why God would let my parents die. He thinks if God cared about us, he would have saved our parents. It's a valid viewpoint. I've asked myself the same questions, had the same doubts. But my parents' death has made me a better person. I care more about Dusty now than I ever did before.
I don't think God took my parents from us to force me to be a good brother. I don't think he forces any of us.
That's my point. He lets bad things happen because he doesn't control us. He lets us run our own lives and our actions have consequences, good and bad. The drunk driver who killed my parents made a bad decision. If God had saved my parents, one person's bad decision, to drive intoxicated, wouldn't have had a natural and negative consequence. We all have to make mistakes because it's the only way we learn.
He exhaled slowly, pensively.
Some lessons are harder than others.
That's a noble perspective, but I disagree, I said. People drive drunk all the time and no one gets killed. If God really wanted to save your parents, he could have.
Do you wish God had saved your mom?
Chet asked gently. His question caught me completely off guard. For a moment, I didn't know what to say. He was bearing his soul to me, and all I had to give him in return was a carefully crafted lie. My mom wasn't dead. I had nothing in common with Chet, and the fact that I was pretending like I did only made me feel more shallow and deceitful. I hated feeling this way. But what really bothered me, what hurt the most, was knowing Chet thought I was someone I wasn't. Was this how the rest of my life would be? Lying to people and never letting them get close enough to know the real me? I hated Stella Gordon. I hated her more than I'd ever hated anyone. Except, perhaps, my mother.
"I don't believe in God, remember?" was all I said. Ready to switch the topic, I asked Chet, "Do you know any Foxhall?"
He'd taken a pull of root beer, and now he wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"I think so. Short, with dark hair."
"Yeah. Did you know she's pregnant?"
"I did not."
"Come on, small town, news travels."
"It does, toward people who tune their ear to it."
I made a face like he was being too superior.
"Any idea who the father might be?"
"She's in Dusty's grade, I think. He might know."
"Do you know Trigger McClure?"
"Sure."
"Do you think he could be the father?" I didn't have any evidence to back up my suspicion, other than the depressed way Innie had reacted when I suggested Trigger might be leaving town soon to play in the majors. Well, that and the way Trigger seemed to prefer Innie over every other car hop when he came to the sundown. I couldn't shake the feeling that there was more between them than a routine customer-car hop interaction. Chet frowned.
"Trigger and Innie? Instinct tells me no, but I could be wrong."
"What makes you say no?"
He thought about it, shrugged.
"I guess she doesn't seem his type. Again, I could be wrong."
"What's his type?"
The look in his eyes changed from conversational to speculative.
"You're not..."
"Asking for myself? Ew, no, definitely no."
I gave a dramatic shudder, proving my point. I was not interested in Trigger. Chet seemed to relax in his seat.
"If you believe the rumors, Trigger likes older women."
"How much older?"
"Old enough to be experienced."
He looked uncomfortable talking about this, fidgeting with the keys dangling from the ignition.
"There were rumors about him and a female teacher. Far as I know, they were just rumors."
"Oh, stop looking for the good in people," I said. "I wouldn't put fooling around with a teacher past him. What happened to the teacher?"
"She was moved to a different school mid-semester," he admitted reluctantly. "He was already 18 when the alleged relationship happened, so the story didn't catch wind."
"See," I said, knowingly, then added with disgust, "of course she took the fall for it. Just like it had been my fault when Trigger's Mountain Dew found its way onto my face. Every female who crossed paths with Trigger seemed to be at fault. Funny how that kept happening."
"He has a reputation for a nasty temper."
There was a muted quality to Chet's voice, part discomfort, part warning.
"And he's physical."
"With girls?"
"With everyone. Maybe with that teacher. I don't know the facts, just watch yourself with him."
He eyed the clock.
"I should get you home. Carmina's going to be pacing the doorway with a shotgun."
I made a pouty face, but he obviously had great self-control, because seemingly immune to my charms, he drove us back to Carmina's, parked in the drive at 11:45 on the dot. The downstairs lights were on, but I didn't see Carmina's prowling silhouette through the curtains.
"Thanks for the root beer float," I said.
"Anytime."
A notable pause followed. Chet's eyes found mine, and the hot look in them made me wish I hadn't allowed myself to be alone with him. It was dark in the cab of the Scout, and while the bench seat had seemed roomy every other time I'd ridden beside him, it now felt just the opposite. He sat so close I could feel heat radiating off his body. I could hear his slow, deep breathing. He rested his arm on the seat back, his hand draped inches from my shoulder. I was hypersensitive to the sweet, spicy scent of him, and even though he wasn't touching me for one whirlwind moment, I thought he might. I felt tipsy and nervous, my nerve endings electrified with anticipation. And then I saw Reed's face. It popped into the back of my mind, and the image was so real, I almost believed he could see me. I shoved out of the Scout, practically jumping onto the drive, feeling spooked. Smiling as naturally as I could under the circumstances,
I told Chet, I'd better get the rest of this float in the freezer before it melts. I didn't look at his face. I didn't want to see that slow heat again and be forced to speculate what it meant. I already knew, but I wasn't going to give it another moment's thought. I had to remember I wasn't Stella Gordon, and I wasn't a foster kid who had a future in Thunder Basin or with Chet. I was Estella Goodwin, and Reed Winslow was my boyfriend. I dashed up the porch steps, thinking Carmina had better not be on the other side of the door ready to have words with me. I couldn't handle it tonight. I wanted to clear my head of Chet and focus on what was important, my next trip, to the library. Reed was out there somewhere, and he was trying to contact me. I was inside the house with my back pressed to the door before I heard Chet reverse down the drive. An image of his blue eyes, deep with yearning, drifted into my mind. He'd been easy on the eyes from the first moment I'd seen him, but I'd never found him as attractive as I had in the cab of the scout tonight. I didn't want this complicated attraction. I didn't know what to do with it. I wasn't the kind of girl who let a guy slip easily under my skin. I was in control here, damn it. But I'd be lying if I said I didn't feel shaken by Chet.
There's a fundraiser at the church tonight, if that sort of thing interests you.
It was the following afternoon, Saturday, and Carmina stood at the kitchen sink plunging her hands into soapy water as she scrubbed barbecue off our lunch dishes.
What kind of fundraiser?
I purposefully kept my tone bland, not wanting to give her the satisfaction of believing she'd piqued my interest, when she hadn't.
To aid the women's shelter.
More details? Is it a car wash? Are they selling popcorn? Overpriced candy bars? In past summers, my basketball team had held weekend car washes when we needed to raise money. It was the first thing I thought of when I heard fundraiser.
Oh, I suppose you'd call it a carnival, she said, using her forearm to nudge a few white hairs that had strayed from her headband off her face. There'll be a ring toss, cakewalk, corn-shucking contest, and that game where you throw darts at balloons.
Will I know anyone? I half wondered aloud.
Reckon you will. Pastor Likens asked several of the youth to help run booths. Plenty of them play in the softball league.
She eyed me over her shoulder.
I imagine Chet Falconer will be there, if that's what you're getting at.
I'm not getting at anything. And I wasn't. I had mixed feelings about seeing Chet again so soon. Last night before bed, I'd put him out of my mind, determined to end whatever complicated feelings I was developing for him. I wanted to keep our relationship simple. Friend simple. Everything was fine until I woke in the dark, my body hot and clammy, and aching. I knew I couldn't control my dreams, but this particular one, involving Chet, the bed of his scout, and his strong, very capable hands, seemed like a betrayal of Reed, and my resolve just the same. Frowning, Carmina said,
"Don't think it slipped my attention he brought you home after curfew last night."
I don't have a curfew. And are you seriously going to have a heart attack over 15 minutes? Ignoring me, she said,
"Fundraiser starts at 7. I promised Pastor Likens I'd get there early to help set up. I'm sure he'd appreciate an extra hand if you decide to come."
"Not really my thing," I said, yawning widely, which was rude, but I needed to make my point.
"Suit yourself."
And that was that. But when 6:30 rolled around and Carmina was backing down the driveway, I had a what-the-hell moment, grabbed my purse and dashed down the porch steps. I felt like an idiot chasing her partway down the road before she thought to look in the rearview mirror. She braked, and I hoisted myself into the truck, heaving breath.
"What?"
I panted in response to her arched eyebrows. "Maybe I'll die from boredom and be out of your hair for good."
"Or maybe you'll have yourself a good time," she said sweetly.
I gave her a cynical look. She smiled, self-satisfied. The church parking lot was full.
Carmina parked on a side street, and I helped her unload boxes of lollipops, gumballs, balloons, and air pumps, and a couple of bottles of drugstore wine for the wine pull. As we carted the boxes across the church's back lawn, we passed booths advertising pie throwing, face painting, and a myriad of carnival games. There was even a dunk tank. The sun blazed above the trees, the heat broiling my scalp. Sweat trickled down my spine. I closed my eyes. It felt like summer. It just didn't feel like summer. Right now, I should have been sunbathing at Tori's pool, or helping her plan her guest list for her birthday party. She turned 18 next Wednesday. I wondered if she still thought about me. Of course she did. We'd been best friends for years. Even if she believed I was dead, I would linger in the back of her mind, making her cry at random moments. I squeezed the bridge of my nose, which was starting to tingle painfully. I couldn't do this. I couldn't keep going back. I was beginning to understand why Deputy Price had told me to start fresh in Thunder Basin. It hurt too much to keep one foot planted in the past. I wanted to hold on to it, but the only thing Philly had to offer me was danger, or worse, death. Keeping it close, pretending it was still an option, was a fantasy. A dangerous fantasy. I grabbed Carmina's wine bottles and took them to Pastor Likens, who bustled around the wine pull table, adding tags to the bottles already lined up in neat rows. "Hello there, Stella," he said, bumping his sunglasses up his nose. He was one of those men who didn't have the face for sunglasses. His was blandly cherubic, and sunglasses looked out of place. They made him look like he was trying too hard. But the rest of his attire was exactly what I would have expected. Dockers, a white shirt, and scuffed loafers. His face shone with perspiration, and the underarms of his shirt bore damp circles. He shook my hand, but his eyes went past me, locking on Carmina.
"Carmina sent you to give these to me? I'll have to seek her out as soon as I finish these tags and thank her."
I turned to go, thinking I'd browse the games before the carnival got underway, when I saw several girls my age clustered around a booth I hadn't noticed before. The booth was wrapped in red paper and decorated with large heart-shaped cutouts. A boombox set on the window's ledge blared a female voice singing enthusiastically, "This kiss, this kiss, unstoppable, this kiss, this kiss." "Who sings this song?" I asked one of the girls at the back of the group. She stared at me like I couldn't be serious.
Faith Hill? It's the song, This Kiss."
She watched me like she was waiting for something to click, but I'd never heard of the song.
"Get it? This Kiss? It's a kissing booth?" she finished impatiently.
Before I could ask if she was serious, a wave of squeals rose up from the girls closest to the booth. A woman was writing names on a poster tacked to the booth's window.
"Trigger McClure," one girl read aloud as the woman printed his name, followed by the 7 o'clock time slot.
"Chet Falconer," another said giddily.
I nudged the girl beside me a second time. "So this is like a real kissing booth? With actual kissing?" It was more a declaration of incredulity than a question. Was this politically correct? Judging by the donations jar, the church was actually condoning the idea of buying, well, kisses. There were so many things messed up about this, I couldn't even start to list them.
Yeah, obviously, the girl said. "The guy who raises the most money at the end of the night is crowned Mr. Hot Lips. He gets a tiara and a sash and everything. It's really funny. Chet or Trigger will win, obviously. I mean, look at the other guys who volunteered," she said as the woman added the final two names to the poster. "Donovan Pippin and Theodore LeMahieu?" The girl wrinkled her nose in distaste. Just then I saw Chet's yellow scout rumble down the street and decided it just wouldn't do to pass up an opportunity to tease him. Practically skipping across the yard, I met up with him on the sidewalk.
"Kissing booth?" I said sweetly, keeping step with his long, easy stride.
He looked casual and comfortable in jeans, grass-stained boots, and a navy t-shirt that highlighted those striking jewel-blue eyes. He grinned.
"Keeping tabs on me?"
Hard not to. When they wrote your name on the roster, girls within a 10-mile radius swooned and fainted flat on their backs.
But not you.
I don't kiss friends, I quipped. He gave a snort, but the playful glint in his eyes dimmed a little, and I regretted that I might have hurt his feelings. Still, I had to make my intentions clear. I wasn't going to give him false hope, or encourage any more behavior like the kind he'd displayed in the scout last night. Anyway, I added, hoping to repair his ego, a kissing booth takes the serendipity out of the moment. I'm against them on principle. I mean, is there anything less romantic than paying for a kiss? It should happen when the time is right. It shouldn't be forced. It's the difference between kissing someone for the first time in Vegas and Paris, I said in a burst of inspiration.
Have you ever been to Paris?
He grunted, shifting two crates of glass milk bottles in his arms. For one half moment, my heart raced wildly. I thought I'd said something that could jeopardize my cover. But no, the analogy was harmless. You didn't have to travel to Paris to know it was a million times more romantic than Vegas. Even though Estella Goodwin had. Traveled to Paris, that is. You know what I mean, I said.
Did you happen to see what time slot they gave me?
8 o'clock. All eyes, lips, will be on you. I dug in my purse for a tube of lip balm and tucked it in the front pocket of his tee. A friendly deed for a friend in need. Halfway through your shift, you'll thank me. He dug out the tube and read the label, creme de menthe flavored.
For real? This is as close as I'm getting to touching your lips tonight?
He wagged his head pathetically and heaved a sigh of disappointment. I grinned. We were back to our old routine of kidding around and feeling easy with each other. This was what I wanted. It felt safe. Just call me Little Miss Virgin Lips.
At least stop by the booth and say hi.
And donate a couple bucks. Proceeds go to new toys for the women's shelter. You just want my money so you can be the next Mr. Hot Lips. I expected Chet to respond with a wisecrack of his own, but he stopped in his tracks. It was like he'd walked into a wall. His eyes fastened on something across the yard. A little color crept up his neck, and he smoothed a hand through his hair, almost like he was worried it might be sticking up. It seemed to take him a second to breathe. Chet? He jerked, like he'd forgotten I was there. He smiled, but his eyes were far away and moody.
Yeah. Sorry. You were saying?
I glanced at where he'd been staring, but wasn't sure what had distracted him. Surely he wasn't unnerved by the group of girls forming a line in front of the kissing booth. He had to have known what he was getting into when he'd volunteered. And anyway, Trigger had the first shift. Those girls might be gone by the time Chet took over the booth. And then I saw her. A redhead in a Husker's hat and a white tank top. She had a hand on her hip, and the stance showed off her toned arms and shoulders. It was hard to tell if she had great legs, too, because her skirt was one of those billowy hippie kinds that fell below the knees. But I was betting she did. She had a sprinkling of freckles, and she was pretty in an effortless and enviable way. Who is she? I asked him. But I had his full attention now, and he smiled at me, only me.
Who's who? Come on, help me drop off these bottles at the ring toss.
By 8, I'd made the rounds, hitting most of the game booths. I thought it spoke volumes about how starved I was for a social life that I was able to amuse myself at a church carnival. In some small way, it felt good to wander among strangers. But it also made me homesick. I missed Philly. I missed the life and the energy, the juxtaposition of the familiar and the anonymity of city life. I also missed Reed, in a way that made my heart feel like it had been squeezed into a box 3 sizes too small. I wondered if there was any chance I could slip away from the carnival without Carmina noticing. On foot, a trip to the library and back would take about an hour. If she realized I'd left, she'd press me with questions later. Worse, she might heighten her patrol of me or start asking questions around town. In the end, I decided leaving was too risky. As hard as it was to be patient, I had to be.
If Carmina discovered the secret email account, it was all over. I'd lose my only way to contact Reed. Across the carnival, Chet was relieving Donovan Pippin in the kissing booth. As promised, I headed that direction to donate a few dollars to the worthy cause of crowning him Mr. Hot Lips. On my way over, I bumped into Theo, the kid from the Red Barn gas station. He had his head down and was beelining with purpose through the crowd. He almost mowed me over. I jumped back a step. Where's the fire? His head sprang up. Oh, hey, Stella. What are you doing here? Trying to look like I fit in? Want to hit a few booths together? Anything but the rubber duck races. I've struck out twice on them. He began, glancing nervously behind him, almost like he was hiding from someone. Afraid I can't. You haven't seen an older gentleman in seersucker shorts and a yellow polo, have you? Nope. Why? Oh, nothing, he said, still peering around anxiously. He's my grandfather. I'm trying to, avoid him for reasons. I'll catch you later. I grabbed his shoulder. Who's that girl in the Husker's hat by the cakewalk? Theo squinted through his thick glasses. That's Lacey Parrish. She must have come home for the weekend. She goes to UNL. That's in Lincoln, right? Before I came to Thunder Basin, it was the only city in Nebraska I could have named from memory. He nodded. She graduated from high school last year. I heard she got a summer job in Lincoln as an au pair. Lacey graduated last year, the same year Chet graduated. In a town this size, he would definitely know her. But the look in his eyes as he'd watched her was more than familiarity. It was the kind of look you got when someone punched you in the chest and your body forgot how to breathe. What's the deal with her and Chet Falconer? Theo considered. Well, they used to date, but they're definitely not together anymore. He was supposed to go to school in Omaha. It's not far from Lincoln. So he and Lacey could basically still be together, but then his parents were killed in a car crash. He stayed here to take care of his brother, and she took off for college. But first, she broke up with him. I heard she told him she didn't want to wait for him, and she didn't want a long-distance relationship either. Before the car crash, everyone in town talked about how they were destined to get married. What do they call those kinds of people? A golden couple, I think. But now they're more like an old divorced couple. I don't think they've said a word to each other since she left town. That's a sad story, I murmured. Across the yard, Chet leaned out the window of the kissing booth, delighting a small girl with Shirley Temple curls as he pecked her on one rosy cheek. In return, she dropped a dollar bill into the donations jar and skipped away. It was a sweet picture, and in spite of myself, I felt my heart melt a little. As though sensing me watching, Chet turned his eyes toward mine. We held that gaze for no longer than 3 or 4 seconds, but in that moment, it felt much, much longer. I dropped my eyes to his mouth, which had more color from the repeated pressure of kissing, the same way slapped skin deepens with blood. Chet watched me back, a strange, wishful tension in his eyes. It put me on alert. Uh-oh. I wasn't doing this. I made myself flash him a radiant smile. Then I blew him a goofy kiss, puckering my lips and smacking them apart dramatically. I knew the distraction had worked when he grinned and crooked his finger for me to come over. The moment, whatever it was, had passed. Gotta run, Theo gulped, dodging away before I could ask him any more questions. Tempted by what Theo had told me, I sauntered over to the cakewalk. Studying the cake designs, I listened to Lacey Parrish and the girls huddled around. From their group rose the hush of gossip, punctuated by the occasional spurt of laughter. "Have you talked to him?" one of the girls asked Lacey. Lacey stared knives at the girl like, "Did you really just ask me that?" The girl blushed. "Stupid question," she mumbled. "I saw him staring at me earlier," Lacey said, rolling her eyes. Could he make it any more obvious? He still has a thing for me, but I'm so over him. Like, he can't compete with college guys, you know? It's harsh, but true. They're doing stuff with their lives, and he's...
She hesitated, searching for the word of impact.
A lawn boy.
A couple of girls snickered.
Lacey grinned, pleased with herself, then sobered her expression and added,
I mean, I felt super guilty when his parents... You know.
She gestured for her audience to fill in the blank.
But I'm not going to put my life on hold for some guy I made out with in high school.
If he thought we were forever, he had the wrong girl. I'm doing something with my life. College is amazing. You guys will see. It's a different world. There's something happening every night. Parties, dances, football games.
She laughed.
More parties.
So, do you have a boyfriend?
A girl with a red bandana tying her hair back asked. She reminded me of Rosie the Riveter. Her voice was tough, a little challenging.
Nobody dates in college.
Lacey flicked her hair over her shoulder, all casual, but she was lapping up the attention. Her green eyes glittered and she spoke loudly and with authority.
It's less serious than high school. You don't feel pressure to belong.